I've enjoyed being here. I believe as fully as I have enjoyed being any place in my ministry. Been very kind, very attentive. I'm sorry that I choked up a time or two and my voice hasn't been normal, but I can't help that. I think it'll be better this evening. Hope so. I feel a little better. I called my folks this afternoon. They're all right. As usual, I was called to conduct the funeral of two good friends this week. Two other of my friends have passed away. That's four of them since I've been up here. And I told my folks it's about an average two a week. And that's about right. And I'm sorry that I could not accommodate those that I've loved so long. I had buried members of their family, and I'll see the remainder of the family when I return home. I believe our program has been changed a little bit. We had planned to leave here about, I believe Brother Perdue said, about 3 o'clock Monday morning. But I'm glad he's changed that. We'll leave immediately after noon Sunday. Brother Powers has got to get on a plane about 4 o'clock in Portland. We're to get on a plane the next morning at 8, maybe a little after, and be a rather long day to leave here at 3 o'clock in the morning and get home about 8 o'clock that night. So I'm glad it's being shortened. Brother Perdue has arranged for Brother Powers to preach Sunday morning. I think he's going to work me in somewhere in the program for some contribution Sunday morning. I've got 10 minutes till 8. I don't know how long I'll talk. But 10 minutes till 8 is about 10 minutes earlier than I've been starting. And I've tried to quit by the time I've supposed to have been getting done. I'm going to begin sort of where I left off this morning. And tomorrow, in both messages, if the Lord wills it, will be on the Baptists in America. I brought a tape with me that has a speech of Patrick Henry recorded on it in my voice. I had to read it out of a book in defense of some Baptists being tried in Virginia. That speech, I haven't timed it. It'll be probably 10 or 12 minutes long. I read that book in a dormitory in a school in West Virginia. The only one like it I've ever seen. Jay Holliday owned the book, and he wouldn't hardly let me take it out of his room into mine to read it. He guarded it. The title of it is Persecuted Baptist in Virginia. And I read probably 2 hours out of the book. I think it'll mean more to you to hear Patrick Henry's speech in the morning for about 10 or 12 minutes than mine. So in the program, it'll be arranged for those who are present off this tape to hear that speech when I talk about the Baptists in Virginia. Tonight, I'm going to talk more about the Baptists in England and Wales, and probably that'll take all the time that I'll have this evening. This morning, I mentioned the fact that the Romans conquered England 50 years before Christ was born. They had their soldiers quartered there continually. And when the Christian religion was carried to Wales sometime in the year 60, probably about 63 A.D. The gospel was planted in Wales. And for 100 years or more, the influence spread slowly. But in the year 187 A.D., a Welsh king named Lucius was converted to the Christian religion. It's claimed that Constantine was the first emperor, but he was about near 200 years behind the first king that was converted. When Lucius, king of the Welsh, was saved by the grace of God, he rejoiced so much in his salvation being preached to by our forebears who were in Wales that he wanted to see his entire populace in his kingdom saved by the grace of God. He sent to Rome and had missionaries brought out of Rome into Wales to preach to his people. They went along fine until a little after the year 200, when the Roman soldiers who had been quartered in Wales and England through all of the period from 50 years before Christ were authorized to help enforce the persecution in England. Diocletian's orders were: destroy every Christian and every piece of literature that pertains to Christianity. When we go back through the period of the Dark Ages, both in Europe, Asia, and in England and Wales, our history, so far as contributions by our people, is vague. They burned all of our literature for around 1,000 years. Much of our history has to be traced as to the identity of the people and the location by what our people were accused of believing by our enemies. That happened in England. Our people predominated in Wales from the time Claudia and Pudens carried the gospel back there until close to the 6th century. There was no infant baptism in England until close to the year 600 A.D. In 596 A.D., the Roman powers, Roman Catholics, sent a man named Austin into England to convert the Saxons. He baptized, it said, in one day 10,000. I guess he sprinkled them. He carried sprinkling for baptism into England, and there hadn't been any such thing in England until Austin went there. All right, after Austin had dealt with the Saxons in England, then he goes into Wales with the idea of either converting or destroying the Baptists. Going back to the council in Nicaea by Constantine in 325, when the church was married to the state, and it became a state church supported by the armed knights of Rome to enforce its decrees. So Austin had backing him up the Roman army that is in England and in Wales. When he undertook to deal with the Baptists, either to kill them or convert them, I read a story that said that he had 1,200 of our preachers executed. That's quite a crowd of preachers to perish under the persecution of one Roman Catholic. That persecution in Wales had the same effect that decree in 412 I mentioned about in Africa and Europe in Wales. I've never been to Wales. I've been to England a couple of times, but I didn't have an opportunity to go into Wales. I longed to do it, but I couldn't. But it's a mountainous country. Just like our people, like the Waldensians, found their harbor of safety in the mountains of northern France, southern France and northern Italy, what we call the Piedmont Valleys. Wales had their Piedmont Valley in Wales. And under the wave of persecution that resulted from Austin coming, they were either to agree to his philosophy and theology, practice his baptism, or be sentenced to death. So our people have always faced persecution. I've read The Trail of Blood, and the book is more or less true. Our people have almost left a trail of blood from the times of the Lord and the apostles until now in all ages of the world. You know, if we knew how many of our brethren in Russia are being martyred now, we'd be astonished. We'd be astonished. And in maybe other countries of the world. So our people hid in the mountain recesses of Wales from around the year 600 A.D. until the time of the Reformation. So we have of our people in Wales a dark age of almost 1,000 years. Henry VIII of England, and a lot of other folks that I'll deal with a little bit later on in my message this evening, and I hope that I'll be able to offer something that will help somebody a little bit. I want to read a note I made here. The Baptists were forced into the mountain recesses of Wales. That became their Piedmont for almost 1,000 years. But like the Waldensians, they remained loyal and perpetuated in Wales true and sound doctrine until the time of the Reformation. Now, last night I had come to the reformers, John Calvin in France and Martin Luther in Germany, and I want to deal with them briefly. When the Reformation started, Martin Luther and John Calvin both were trained for the priesthood in the Roman Catholic Church. Somewhere, somehow, Martin Luther read, "The just shall live by faith." And that thing went home to him. And I read this story about him. While he was in college, he had a buddy. We're close together. They were walking a pathway under some trees. And a limb from a tree fell and struck his buddy on the head and killed him by the side of Luther. That impressed him of the suddenness of death. And awakened within him a desire to learn what happened to a man when he died. What hope does he have? And I've been told that that tragedy in his life led eventually to his conversion. I have literature that tells about Luther's conversion. After he was converted, or before he was, I don't know whether this is so or not, but I read it, that in order to perfect his training for the priesthood, he made a trip to Rome, to the Vatican. And you know, the high papa sits on a throne up some stairs, and his subject crawled up the stairs to kiss his toe. This story that I read that said that Luther went to Rome and was going up humbly to the steps, honestly, to kiss the Pope's toe. And there where it dawned on him, the just shall live by faith. He never did get to the top. He turned around and walked back. When he went home, he had learned enough about the corruption in his religion that he wrote his famous 95 Theses. Well, I had studied church history, general church history, and Baptist church history. I knew about Luther's theses, but I never found them in any piece of literature, what these 95 Theses were that he wrote and pinned or tacked on the door of the cathedral in Wittenberg. But I finally found them. I bought the only kind of set of books of its kind I've ever seen. And I hope someday that this set of books will go into the library in the seminary in Little Rock. It's called the Library of Original Sources. There's about 8 big volumes. Have any of you ever seen that set of books? But if you ever do get it, because it's worthwhile, Luther's theses are in there. Every one of the 95 theses was a condemnation of some heretical or tyrannical thing in his church, the Roman Empire. Then he was tried in the Diet of Worms, and he thought they'd kill him. They had those theses. They didn't know who wrote them. Luther was suspicioned. They finally brought him before the Diet and asked him if he wrote them. And he said, "If I perish, I perish. Yes, I wrote them." And he was willing to die then for the faith that he had found. Leaving Luther, I don't think Luther planned to establish a church. But he gathered a great following. And as a result of his philosophy and theology, the Lutheran Church was founded. And during the persecution of our people in Europe, his force helped to do it as Anabaptist. And when they had that film or motion picture a few years ago of Martin Luther, I was pastor of a church in Pine Bluff. The theater sent me a special invitation to come for the preview. Folks asked me if I'm going. I said, "What business have I got down there trying to laud a man that persecuted my forebears in Europe many, many years ago?" And I didn't go. So Luther condoned the punishment and the persecution of Baptists because our people rebaptized those who were associated with him and they came to him. Brethren and sisters, the main bone of contention in the world has always been baptism. And it is now. It is today. All right, John Calvin. John Calvin was born of a family of about 5 children. He was trained also for the priesthood in the Roman Catholic Church. And he wasn't converted for a good long time. He, tired of the study for the priesthood, went to Paris and studied law. He became proficient in law. But he was a student of the things in his church, and he, like Luther, rebelled against the heresies and corruption in the church. And in the Reformation, the struggle of people for religious freedom from the tyranny of Rome, Calvin and Luther were the leaders. So Calvin started his movement in Paris, and he was run out of Paris and went to Switzerland. While in Switzerland, his philosophy was such that he was run out of Switzerland for a while. Finally went back to Switzerland. It was Geneva, wasn't it, where he settled? In Geneva, Switzerland. He had been saved, and it's very interesting to me to read it, the testimony of his salvation. He himself was persecuted and hated to death. He revised the works of Augustine. Augustine was born a little after 400, the year 400. Augustine's early life was of a freelancer. He was a social man. He was a tough character. And his mother was a Christian. He was influenced somewhat by his mother, and after a while, he felt some inclinations toward soul satisfaction. He tried to find it with the Manichaeans. They didn't satisfy him, so he eventually, while even he was a Roman Catholic, he found the way of Christ, and Augustine was saved. There wasn't any such doctrine taught by any of the church fathers, nor the post-church fathers, until Augustine. According to the present understanding of the doctrine of foreordination, election, and predestination, that idea began with Augustine. John Calvin revived it. Not only did John Calvin lead in the religious establishment in Switzerland, in Geneva, he gained control of the political establishment. And he became the power that be in Switzerland. There, in order to propagate his doctrine of the revival of Augustinianism, what we call Calvinism, or rather I'd rather call it Hartschellism, and he started a school. And that school became very prominent, and the reason Calvinism scattered so well all over the then known world, people knew about Calvin, they knew about his school. They'd go there to the school from different countries, and they'd get saturated with that Calvinistic theology, go back and spread it in their own countries. John Knox was in Wales. And he was run out of Wales for his religion. He fled to Switzerland, got tied up with Calvin, went to that school, got saturated with and believed the Calvinistic doctrine. And Calvin had organized a church in Geneva built on that philosophy and theology. Knox got it, carried it back to England, and constituted in Wales the Presbyterian Church. And the Presbyterian Church grew and flourished in Wales and in England. And eventually, Oliver Cromwell, as I'll talk about a little later, was identified with the Presbyterians, and I'll deal with him a little bit later. Now, not only were these men, Calvin and Luther, had influence in Europe, but their influence spread into England. And after the few dives they had, the Treaty of Augsburg and of Trent and another one or two, where more or less religious liberty and the Reformation had in a main succeeded, there was a revival of religion in England. And our people came out from their hidden recesses in the mountains And our people grew very rapidly, both in England and in Wales. And I want to note now a little bit more about the persecutions that came. After the establishment and the freedom, growth, and development of our people, Henry VIII of England was a Roman Catholic. And when he came to the throne of England, he married his brother's widow, Catherine of Aragon. And she was older than he was. After a while, he tired of Catherine. But he was a Roman Catholic, and he called himself the guardian of the faith, the Catholic faith in England. So he wanted to divorce Catherine and marry a girl named Anne Boleyn. But the Roman religion forbade him to do it. He prevailed on the Pope to grant him the privilege of divorcing his wife and marry this other girl. The Pope wouldn't do it. He separated the Catholics of England from the Holy See, as they call it in Rome, and originated the Episcopal religion. Well, Henry VIII had 6 wives. I don't know whether what I read about him is true or not. But not only did he marry Anne Boleyn, but he killed Catherine. And he caught Anne Boleyn, he thought, guilty of marital infidelity and had her killed. He married a woman named Jane Seymour. He got tired of her, and he had the fellow that introduced her to him, and her both killed. Finally, he married Catherine Parr, and she killed him. So that's the way Episcopalianism started, if the history that I've got is true. And that's the kind of fellow that started it. All right, the Baptists were persecuted to death by James I of England. Wycliffe was martyred. But Wycliffe was one of our people. Wycliffe was a Baptist. He wrote his interpretation of the Bible. He translated the scriptures. They destroyed his works. Wanted to destroy him, but he died before he was martyred. And 50 years later, they dug up his bones and ground them to powder and spread them on a river. It was under this persecution that John Bunyan was kept in prison. John Bunyan was a Baptist. Kept him in prison for 11 years. God overruled a lot of things to his glory. Pilgrim's Progress is said to be the greatest allegory that was ever written. I don't know whether you studied it or not, but in the literature of the world, Pilgrim's Progress is held first after this book. And it was written by John Bunyan while he was in prison under the persecution of that time. When William Tyndale translated the Bible into English, you say, well, what's the matter? Do you believe the Roman Catholic laity reads the Bible today? Maybe some of them do on the side. But the Bible to be read and taught by the priesthood. And by the priesthood only teaching the Bible, they can teach the folks what they want to. That's what they want to. And when some of them, like Luther and Calvin, got a hold of the Bible and read it, they learned better. And William Tyndale fled out of England, and his Bible was published and destroyed, and under James I, he was burned at the stake. And it said that his dying words were, in the flames, "Lord, open the King of England's eyes." 10 years later, the King James Version of the Bible came out. Evidently, the Lord opened his eyes. Charles I persecuted the Baptists to death. Charles II, William of Orange had a lot to do with religious liberty in England, but I'll not discuss that. Oliver Cromwell came into England, or was in England, came into prominence, identified himself with the Presbyterians. Then he determined to overthrow Catholicism and Episcopalianism in England. Our people in England, longing for religious liberty, since Cromwell was warring against their enemies, many, many of the Baptists joined Cromwell's armed forces and fought with Cromwell's army to overthrow Catholicism and Episcopalianism in England, and they succeeded. And lo and behold, after he came to power as the procurator of England, he determined then to make all England Presbyterian. And our people, who had fought side by side with his soldiers in order to gain religious liberty, were persecuted to death by Oliver Cromwell. Bloody Mary. Bloody Mary was determined to overthrow the influence of Presbyterianism and restore Catholicism. So she killed both Baptists and Presbyterians. Elizabeth, who was the daughter of Anne Boleyn, Henry VIII's wife, and she and Bloody Mary were sisters. When Elizabeth came to the throne, she wanted to have a great influence in the field of religion, and there was persecution under her. Will you let me be a little personal? During that persecution, one of my ancestors named Robert Glover, who was a Baptist preacher, was sought and arrested. Really, they intended to arrest his brother James and try and convict him. But when they went to the place where they thought James was, he wasn't there, but Robert Glover was. And my father was named for him, Robert Glover. They arrested Robert Glover, tried him, and burned him at the stake. A little later on, James Glover, that they aimed to execute, died a natural death and was buried. They dug his body up and threw it over the wall into the highway for the officers, for the animals to trample on. So, by blood, I do have that heritage, that one member of my ancestors burned at the stake under the persecution in England. All right. Going a little bit further. Under these persecutions, our folks were caused to flee, many of them to flee England. But during this time, our people became great in England. They organized associations in England and in Wales, both like we have here. Their declarations of faith were substantially the same as ours. And they, fleeing England, some of them went across the channel to Holland, established churches in Holland, and from that set up in Holland in 1641, they had been called 200 or 300 years by the name Anabaptist. But we were first called Baptist in Europe, Holland, in 1641. One of the greatest Baptists of all time lived in that area. His name was Brut. You find his name written on the pages about all of the history of the English Baptists. I had sought Crosby's history of the Baptists of England a long time. I couldn't find it anywhere. And 2 or 3 years ago, a book exchange over in Tennessee had it on their catalog, and they sent me a copy of it. I said, all right. It is in 4 volumes for $257. I just sent them a check for $257 for those 4 books, and they sent them back to me. Now you can buy the whole thing for $35. I think it's in 2 volumes, but I paid $257 for my 4. And after I got them, if I didn't know that they were going to get cheaper than that, but if I couldn't have them, I wouldn't take $1,000 for them. And our history in England and in Wales, honestly, is as sound as our history in the 1880s. They met the strongest persecution possible and stood up like I hope if we were persecuted here, we would stand up. And the American continent had been discovered. It had begun to be colonized. And let me tell you this. My ancestors came from England. And I was interested in the clever genealogy. I told the folks over at Brother Perdue's house about this the other day, I believe. In my dad's lifetime, he and I have sought to trace the family history back as far as we could. And the name Glover is Saxon. It comes from those Saxons back there. They originally spelled it G-O-L-O-F-R-E, Golofer. You know what it means? Loud crier. And the way that name started, you know, the towns would have a crier. He'd beat a drum on the street corner, didn't have any newspaper and things like that. They depended on mouth to ear for the news. Well, this Golofer would beat the drum, the folks would gang up, he talks so loud, they called him Golofer. And that's transferred from Saxon to Glover, and I don't think I've inherited any of that, but I've been accused of talking loud and too much. Maybe that's where I got it, was from Golofer. But anyhow, when America had been colonized, and under these persecutions that raged on for quite a long while, our people began to look across the sea. Not only our people, but the Congregationalists and others had to flee England for the persecution or suffer intensely there. And that led to a migration, not only of our people, but of others, from England to our shores. And tomorrow morning, I'll try to deal with how they left England, how they became established in this country, what they did in this country, and the influence of Baptists on the formation of our government and the obtaining of religious liberty in this country. So in the next 2 lectures, I'll do my best to bring you what little knowledge I have of them and can do it in the short time allotted. May the Lord bless you and thank you. I'm glad that I belong to a church whose history goes back to Jesus Christ, and whose votaries or members have been so sound in the faith so loyal in their convictions, so devoted to their and love they have for God, that they love truth more than they love life. And so many, many millions of them have died in defense of the faith. I'm glad to be identified with a bunch like that. I wouldn't consider myself a rich man, but I'll give any man, woman, anywhere here or anywhere else, $100 to show me one place where the Baptists ever persecuted anybody. Our weapon is love. Not a faggot nor a flame. It's love. About all of the denominations in these ancient ages were our persecutors. I'm glad I don't belong to an institution that burned Baptists at the stake. I'd far rather be on the receiving end than the delivering end of such a persecution. And I would that every American that loves freedom, I've wondered how an American who believed in political freedom will tie himself up in a religious organization that denies him absolute religious freedom. Somebody else thinks and talks for him. All he does is to obey. I read in the Constitution of one organization, in directing its candidates for the ministry, don't change our rules, obey them. Obey them. Well, I'm glad nobody's dictating to me what to believe or not to believe. I'm glad that I am free, spiritually. And as a result of the sufferings and sacrifices of Baptists, under God, I'm free politically. Baptists have had more to do with it than all the rest of the people in the world concerned. I'll try to prove that in the next two lectures. Do you belong to that kind of a church? If you don't, you don't belong to the kind I belong to. I say again, don't take my word for it. My authority is here. From this book, satisfy your own mind as to whether you are right in your religion. And if this book teaches you you are wrong, under God, change it. Above all things else, be right in your religious affiliations and in your religious devotions. I believe, I'm satisfied. I'm convinced I belong to the church that Jesus built. And if any of you have never been saved, you're lost and undone without God and His Son. As Paul put it to the Ephesians, you're aliens to the commonwealth of Israel, strangers to His covenant, without God, and without hope in the world. Get right with God by admitting you're a sinner, trusting your sinful soul to the loving and regenerating care of the crucified Lord, and He'll save you. What a pity. So many folks, I'm saved. Well, I don't doubt that. And never be baptized. You know, so it sort of makes me doubt their statement they're saved. I won't deny it, but I can doubt it to be sufficient. I know when I was saved, I wanted to be baptized, but I wasn't for 4 years, but I wanted to all the time. And I told you the other night why. My daddy was a Prejudiced Methodist steward. And I was a boy, and I was afraid he'd rebuke me, and I didn't want to be rebuked.
But Lord knows what a day it was when I was baptized. I've never doubted it. Be satisfied in your religion that your religion harmonizes with this book. And if any of you here tonight that feels deep down in your heart that I wish I had what he says he's done, you can find it at this altar and in this book. And while we stand and sing a verse or two, and the pastor takes charge, will you come forward?
Number 141. 141.